Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you backstage and behind the scenes with the stars and creators of the hottest shows on Broadway, off Broadway, and beyond. I'm your host, Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'm talking to the actor Brian Cox, no relation, with a long and very active career that's seen him play everyone from King Lear to Hermann Göring to Winston Churchill to Hannibal Lecter. Brian is having something of a pop culture moment right now, thanks to his role as the fictional media mogul Logan Roy in Succession. And just as that HBO series saw its popularity explode during its recently concluded second season, he also stepped into the Broadway spotlight this fall, portraying President Lyndon B. Johnson in The Great Society, playwright Robert Schenken's sequel to his Tony-winning play All the Way. Brian's in the studio with me now to talk Shakespeare, Succession, his sprint to prepare for The Great Society, and what's been gained and lost in the entertainment industry over the years. Hi, Brian. Thanks for joining me.
My pleasure, Gordon.
So I'm talking to you in the last, just at the start of the last month of your run in Great Society. Mm-hmm. What are you enjoying about doing the show? And has what you are enjoying changed over the course of the run?
No, I'm enjoying I love the play. And I love the fact that the play deals with issues which not a lot of American theater deal with.
Yeah, you know? Like what specifically?
Well, the historical aspect of how we are where we are, and especially in our current political climate, it is very much reflected in what went on in the 60s. And you'll see that in movements that America always takes a time to play catch up with its political life. I mean, Johnson, you know, the slaves were freed in 1865. Right. But it wasn't until 1965 that they got voting rights.
Right.
So it's quite fascinating from that point of view. And that whole, I mean, I love Bob's work. I think it's almost Shakespearean.
This is Robert Schenken, the playwright.
Robert Schenken, the playwright. And I love the fact that he's tackling a subject which is both classical in its demands, because it is like doing one of the Shakespeare history plays.
That was one of my questions, actually, is how much, because you have a lot of experience with Shakespeare, and I wondered how much something like this reminded you of something.
Well, very
like,
much so.
Yeah.
And you need that kind of energy, you know.
Right.
Bill Rausch, our director, talks about language to language, so that you really have to come in. You can't hang about with it. And Bob
language writes, to language? Is that what you're saying?
Language to language. Uh-huh. It means that there are no pauses.
Okay. Got it.
You know, that you pick up
right
from where you go off. You know, a scene stops and then you start.
And then you keep, yeah.
You know, you don't go pause, wait, what have you, wait,
right.
Make a moment. And you have no time for that.
Right.
And that's the demand. I mean, that is why the play is immensely difficult to do.
I bet.
And it was so difficult because we only did it in 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I just done this TV show.
Yes. How soon had your shooting that ended before you picked up rehearsal? Oh, my God.
A week.
Yeah.
And I had to start with the lines. And, of course, it's 154 pages.
Mm-hmm.
I only had 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So, and originally Jeffrey Richards intended it to be a...
This is Jeffrey, the producer.
Jeffrey Richard, the producer. He intended it to be a dramatized reading because he had the theater for this time. So he wanted to go for the theater, said, and he was desperate to do the play.
Right.
Said, we'll do it as a dramatized reading. Bill clearly didn't think that was such a good idea. And then he, I mean, and I said, okay, fine. He said, yeah, we'll probably have a few LBJs. They'll change. I said, oh, really? Okay. And so, would you do the first batch? And I said, sure, thinking it was a dramatized reading.
Right.
So I agreed. And then Bill called me and said, you know, we'd like you to do longer. Right. I said, oh, that's fine. Okay. As long as you pay me, being a Scot, I thought, right. Yes, okay. You know.
Right.
And then the next thing I knew was we're going to do it as a full production, not as a dramatized reading.
Right.
So I suggested to Bill that you could possibly kill me in the process because
yes.
of the demands. So I had 3 weeks to do it. And I knew I have this wonderful assistant friend who's been helping me called Mickey Abati. Mm. And he taught me the lines. He literally had to teach me the lines. And I had knew 80% of them by the time we came to the first preview.
Right.
And I said to Bill, I said, you know, I can't, you know, I have every waking hour I devote to this and I'm not a kid anymore.
Right.
And he said,
is it harder now to memorize lines?
No,
you find?
It's
yeah,
not.
No, yeah.
It's just, yeah. It's not. It's
yeah.
just that this is a ridiculous. Anybody
it's just
would
a huge,
find,
yeah,
this,
yeah.
Anybody
lift,
would
yeah.
find this, you know,
right.
no matter who they were.
Yeah.
And actually, younger people would probably even find it harder because they get more distracted.
Right.
So I'm older, I don't get as distracted.
Right.
So in a way, what we agreed on was, well, first of all, I was going to take the book on to show that it was something in process. It was previews.
Right.
And then they weren't keen on that idea, which I understood, but I also thought it showed really what the demand of the play was.
Yeah.
So we came up with a system of having an earpiece.
Right.
So I had an earpiece for the first 10 days of the preview.
How hard? That seems really hard to have to like...
Well, it's hard. It's hard because it's only... you learn to do it. And Mickey and I, Mickey's an old friend, so...
Right.
He kind of adjusted. Mickey's interesting because he was deaf as a child.
Oh, wow.
And when we were rehearsing the lines, I kept saying, you know, I keep hearing. I'm a bit deaf as well. Mm. And then he confessed to me. He said, you know, I was deaf. I only learned to speak when I was about 8. And I went, oh, really? And I said, that could be a problem. Thinking when we do. But actually, he was perfect, absolutely perfect.
Right.
But the interesting thing was we did it in that way that we, and you they feed the line in. And of course, if I pause, he will feed the line in.
Mm-hmm, right.
And then it gets me going. I mean, I just need a word and I'm away.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was like that for the... I mean, I kind of knew it, but, you know, I wasn't 100% with it, you know, about 80% with it. But I knew the shape and everything. And I'd worked it because I'd worked it every day with the book, with the book, with the book. And,
right.
and understood the demands of the volition of the play. You know, because it has to have tremendous volition.
Right.
So I kind of took it up on that level, and it seemed to work. You know, and then finally we got to the opening, and you know, and the rest is the history
right, yes.
of the play. You know?
Yeah. Right. Yeah. And you've played real people before. You played, you know, Winston Churchill, and you know, a
Hermann Göring.
Of, exactly.
Winston
oh yeah,
Churchill.
Hermann Göring. Exactly.
Yeah.
How do you think about as an actor? How do you think about trying to do something to sort of convey some sort of mannerism or the way they speak or their physical versus
well,
your own interpretation?
Well, they have clear... I mean, if you're playing Churchill, I mean, his manner has gone mad, you know, in terms of, you know, the V sign, the cigar, the hats, the whole thing of him.
Yeah.
The drinking.
Yeah.
And his speech, you know, that thing that he had, which was... His performance speech is very different from his speech, you know, that he didn't speak, like when you hear him speaking in real life, occasionally you pick him up, like there's a couple of videos where he's speaking, doing the speaking,
yeah.
and then he's talking, he's saying, well, what did you think of that? So he's much more
right.
natural. So there was this performance element, and there's always the performance element. Especially if you play a politician.
Right, yeah.
You know, because they're the biggest performers there is.
Right.
Now, Lyndon Johnson, it's the Texas speech. It's getting that vernacular, getting the way he used, and also he used his, I mean, he could be very, with his own people, he could be very fast, very cruel, very, you know.
Right.
But when he talks to other people, he could be a lot slower. Like, there were fascinating conversations. And the LBGA tapes, which is a series of DVDs which you can get, of him talking to Jackie Kennedy, for example, just within weeks of Kennedy's assassination.
Wow.
And he's very, very, very considerate, almost kind of slightly kind of seductive in a way. I mean, not consciously. Yeah. And she completely melts when she speaks to him. And that was what was interesting, is the effect that he has on people. So you knew that this was a incredibly complicated character, but I mean, and full of contrast, but kind of true, very true, but also a politician, and also getting his own way. So those you put into the mix, and with a sense of, you know, a physical sense of who they look like, what they are, that's a given. But in Johnson's case, it's very much, even more than Churchill, ironically, it's very much to do with his speech.
Hmm.
You know, it's to do with how he used his Texas drawl.
Right.
And the lovely thing in the play is there's this reminder, my favorite speech in The Great Society is when he talks about his growing up period as a kid in the hill country and all the women he grew up and how he brought electricity. And you realize this is the man he was, you know, that he became a congressman. And he grew out of that. And again, to go to the Shakespearean side of it, it's epic. And he's the president, so he's a kind of like a Shakespearean king. And he has these flaws, which finally... The thing about telling a lie, how you start off with one little lie and how it builds up to bigger lies and how eventually, as he says in the play, I don't know where I am anymore or who I am. So there's a sort of tragic momentum to the part, you know, which makes the part very, very demanding, very challenging, and also very rewarding.
It sounds like you did a fair amount of research on him.
Well, I did a research, but I had to do it very quickly. I mean, I couldn't read. I couldn't read the Caro books. I mean,
right.
You know, because I would still be reading the Caro books. You know, I mean, I hear they're great, and I actually promised myself I am going to read the Caro books now, because his work is extraordinary. Mm. But the tapes were the thing that helped me. And that's quick research, because you've got the man himself, and you're hearing the man, so you're dealing with your relationship to the man as opposed to your relationship to an author and the man.
Yeah,
of course, the author I have is Bob Shankin.
Right.
So I go with Robert. I go with Robert's play, and I acknowledge Robert's play and what Robert is doing and what he's attempting to do and how also the context, what you're doing and how important it is in terms, and particularly now, you know, because it really is about the machinations of American political life. You know.
Yeah. Did you see all the way?
No, I never did.
Yeah.
Sadly, because I was working, so I was busy, and so I never saw that.
You didn't catch Bryan Cranston's performance?
No, I never got Bryan's performance. So, it's a different thing. You know, I wouldn't have wanted to see. I mean, if I'd seen Bryan's performance, that would have been the fact. But nature and nurture and all the other stuff didn't allow me to see it because I wasn't available to see it.
And doing Shakespeare, of course, you must have been in plenty of shows where you've seen other people play those roles.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
So,
I mean,
it's a thing that happens.
I've seen lots of Lears. I've seen I've seen more Hamlets than I've had hot dinners.
Sure.
So I've seen those parts being repeated, and it happens in movies too. You know, you look at, I created the role of Hannibal Lecter.
Right.
You
yes.
know, so uh-huh. I mean, and now I see everybody playing Hannibal Lecter since then.
Yep.
So it's a bit, it's an iconic role that's reinterpreted and will be reinterpreted. It's slightly out of fashion, but it will come back.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, remember that?
That's a movie for listeners who don't know called Mindhunter?
Manhunter.
Manhunter. Thank you. Mindhunter is the Netflix
thing.
Series, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And Michael Mann directed that.
Michael Mann.
It was
directed.
An early film of his.
It was his second movie, and it was the first movie that character would be in it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
You mentioned you just finished up working on your TV show. It sort of felt like to me that as Great Society was starting and getting going, that at the same time Succession sort of had this huge explosion in kind of awareness and popularity and sudden interest. I mean, I was one of the people who came on board with this, like, started watching once the second season sort of started and picked up from one and went.
That, a lot of people did that. A lot of people played catch up on that.
Yeah.
That's understandable. That's the great thing about long form television, and also television where you can stream, you can pick it up, you can get it on demand.
Yeah. Did the sort of coincidence of the timing of those two experiences, how did they impact each other?
It was bizarre. It was just totally bizarre. I mean, suddenly there I was doing this, having done this this amazingly, and I could see it. And it was just, I mean, I literally started rehearsing after the final episode. And of course, when the final episode hit the public, I mean, they went...
Which was just, as I'm talking to you, just a couple of weeks ago.
That's right. Yeah. And it kind of went, wow, you know, everybody went crazy about it. Yep. And it was happening while I was still rehearsing. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of weird. It was weird. And it was weird for me because at my age, you know, I mean, I've done a lot of work. But I've never done so much work that has been so to the fore as it was in this time, you know.
Yes, because I can see how not only Succession but also The Great Society in its own way kind of speak to what's happening right now.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, and I'm sort of, and also because I'm older, and there are not very many of us around, they tend to fall off the perch. I mean, I've seen, you know, my comrades over the years. Sadly, some of them live not as long as he should have lived, quite honestly. I'm thinking of my great friend, Alan Rickman, who was a great friend, and we started together, and was still a shock to me when I think that he's not around anymore.
Yeah.
So in a way, I've kind of gained advantage out of that. And also, I always knew as a young actor, I mean, I was told by several people who mentored me when I was young. One was... Lindsay Anderson, the director Anderson.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the other one was a wonderful director, unsung hero of the British theatre, started the wonderful theatre in Manchester called the Royal Exchange, and he was the father of Marianne Elliott. Called Michael Elliott.
Okay.
And he was probably the best theatre director I've ever worked with.
Wow.
I mean, astonishing talent, really. And... obviously, his daughter has picked up on it.
She's not bad herself.
Yeah. No, considerably. And it's interesting because actually Marion was my assistant. I directed Richard III in the 20 years ago.
Wow.
And she was my assistant. So it was kind of bizarre. It's kind of bizarre. So, but Michael actually said to me, he said, it's going to happen much later for you. He said, because I was playing parts way beyond my age when I was in my 20s.
Well, I feel like... Did you play Lear at 40 or something ridiculous?
I was 44 like when I
mean, come on.
I was 44 when I played Lear.
Yeah.
And then previous to that, I played Titus Andronicus,
which
was my biggest Shakespeare success when I was 40.
Right.
So, I mean, I did all of those parts. And in fact, ironically, going back to The Great Society, because of this panic that I had, and I really did have a panic.
Yeah.
How am I going to do this in the time, given my age? I thought, what am I going to do? So I literally had a conversation and called upon my younger self. I literally said, I called up the 40-year-old Brian Cox and said, what do we do? How do we get this through? And he said to me, it's going to be really difficult, but I don't know, let's see that the old muscles are there. And they were.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, physical muscles. I mean, I still have some physical problems because I have to wear lifts on stage.
Yeah,
And
that
my legs really.
It's hard on them.
It's hard on the legs. But so that's fine.
That's to make you as tall as LBJ, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'll never be as tall.
I'll
get up there, you know, to look roughly.
Right.
So I wear that. And so that was one thing. But the other thing was the muscle memory of the brain is astonishing. I mean, you know, I'm at an age now where a lot of people are going into the Alzheimer's zones or the dementia zone, and you know, touch wood. I think there may be wood somewhere. Yeah, touch wood. That's not happening.
Yeah.
But I still forget names, you know. But the but that
well,
old
so
part.
I, so.
That, you know, oh, that's good.
Yeah.
That's very. And when I hear somebody as young as you say that, I always feel very reassured.
Come on, no.
But the interesting thing is that was the thing that got me through it. The old muscle memory that just said you did this. This is what you did, and how you prepared and how you did your day. And of course, my day is. It's all about the play. I mean, because I have no extra energy, you know.
Right. Yeah. I do feel like we should exhort listeners to watch Succession if they haven't already.
Oh, yes.
Only because.
Yeah.
I feel like It is one of the casting directors is Doug Abel, who
runs
the Vineyard
Doug,
Theater.
Yes.
And I feel like every time I turn around on that show, people who have gone to see shows in New York, stage shows in New York for years and years, will recognize almost every single actor on that. Like, they just sort of pick these people who show it. Like, Peter Friedman has a major part on that. Like, I don't know that I've ever seen him on screen before.
No, Peter's wonderful.
Yeah, and he's great. And Jason Cameron.
Jason. I mean, the extraordinary thing about it is that Peter's character keeps getting fired, but Jesse Armstrong, you know, he just says, oh, we'll rehire him.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's well within Logan's lack of morality to do that.
Sure, right.
Logan and, Roy is the character
I'm playing. Exactly. How do you find your theater work sort of filtering into how you work on something like Succession? Because Succession has its own sort of Shakespearean elements to it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's clearly the Lear references.
Yeah,
in
right.
So you know about the overall sweep of it. So you kind of know, you learn quickly about the man, and then you create the man. I mean, you learn what the man's demands are, what Logan's demands are.
Right.
And then you create the man. And you create the man, of course. I mean, I used to get anxious that I didn't have the scripts, you know, in the first series.
Right.
In the second series, I was very grateful not to have the scripts.
That's interesting.
Because I liked the frisson of not knowing. Mm. Because I'd already established who Logan was, and they trust me.
Right.
And you know, apparently I've given them a lot in terms of how they write Logan. They they write it for me, you know, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
So now I will do anything that they ask because we've achieved a kind of wonderful sympathique between one another. Whereas in the first season, I was very much the hired hand, you know, playing the role, and the role was there. Except in fairness to them, each episode was always later and later and later because they were always making that adjustment.
Sure.
And that's how it's worked for all the actors as well, not just me.
I imagine.
It works for Jeremy, it works for Kieran, it works for Tom, you know, Matthew McFadden, and the wonderful Sarah as well. I mean, it's a wonderful cast.
Yeah, it's really great. You started to mention some of your early days in back in the UK in the theater. You were born in the UK and did your training and early work there. What brought you over to the US?
Well, it was a simple thing, really. I always, as a child, I'm Scots.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So my natural predilection, I'm actually a Micmac. I'm an Irish Scot. When a lot of...
I've never heard that term, a Micmac.
Okay. No, a Micmac.
Yeah.
That's the Irish Scot who came this way. Came to Scotland.
Opposed
to, most of them went to America.
Right.
But a few of the foolhardy ones went to Scotland.
Yeah.
And my family came to work in the jute trade business. Mm-hmm. There were the women.
Yeah.
The men were unemployed. They were known as kettle boilers, the men, because that's what they did.
Right.
And they were all farmers. They'd all been farmers.
Right.
But at the time of the famine, there was no work. Right. So, and the skills that were required were people who could spin flax, weave, jute, and weave.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my family. They were all part of that generation. They came from Ireland, and the women did it.
Right.
So that was, you know, that was the ghetto area that I grew up in. So my adherence always in terms of entertainment was always to do with American stuff.
Right.
I mean, I responded much more to the James Cagney, you know, the Pat O'Brien, that sort of those American kind of icons of the time.
Right.
Than I did to Alec Guinness or Kenneth Moore or the English guys, because that was as alien to me as anything. Mm-hmm. So I always had this thing about the movies.
Right.
But of course, the tradition in England is the theatre. It is the, you know, you can't get away from it. We, you know, America is about cinema, but England is definitely about the theatre because of Shakespeare. Mm-hmm. And you can't get around Shakespeare, try as you might. So I became, I worked in the theatre. I started in my hometown in Scotland. And then I eventually went to Lambda. And the reason I went to Lambda because there was this amazing teacher who came up while I was in the theatre, when I was literally the second ASM, and this woman arrived, and the guy who ran the theatre, who was a guy called Bill Davis, who's very famous for playing the smoking man in the, what is it called, that series?
The X-Files,
X-Files, yeah. Bill. And he was, you know, but he ran the theater. And he said, I'm bringing this young woman up and we're having a voice class. He said, would you like to come? And I had no idea what a voice class was. I mean, I had a, Gordon, I had an accent you could cut with a knife. I mean, you really couldn't understand what the hell I was saying. So this woman arrived, young woman, she was very, very young, she was in her, oh, she was in her early 20s, and I just thought, I want to go there, I want to go where the, I want to go to where that woman teaches, and that woman was Kristen Linklater.
Oh, wow, all right.
That's who that was.
Who is, I mean, is she the most famous voice teacher?
Well, she
the,
is.
She is one, she's certainly one of them, if not.
Her
and
Sis Berry
yeah.
are the two
yeah,
most
okay,
famous,
yeah, good
two
one.
Vo-
yep. Yep.
famous voice teachers.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, I went there, and of course, as soon as I went there, she came here.
Right.
She came
right.
to New York and yeah. had this amazing career with Shakespeare and Company and everything
yeah, right.
up there. And but now, ironically, Kirsten is back in Orkney, and she has this voice studio in Orkney, and I'm dying to get there
yeah.
you know, because I'd like to go and get, you know, I'd like to have a, you know, a retread.
Yeah.
But so that was a great influence to me. And then why I came to America was in the 90s, I was very, it was great because I ended up doing theater. I did a hell of a lot of theater, and
right.
I would go from theater and that. But there was always this thing of movies, and we never really had a movie industry in the UK. We did movies, and we did a lot of great movies.
Right.
But from my point of view, the great time of movies was the free cinema of the 60s with, you know, Lindsay Anderson, Carl Rice, Tony Richardson, actors like Alan Bates, Albert Finney, Tom Courtney,
right.
Peter O'Toole. That was a great period for me.
Yeah.
And it was a very liberating period. It was the greatest period of social mobility. It has since evaporated, needless to say.
Mm.
But what happened was I always had this appointment that I needed to make with a movie career, and I put it off, and I was 50.
Yeah.
I was 50 when I came here, and it happened because I used to go from television to the theater very happily and did a lot of great television in the UK.
Right.
But I was, you know, I was, and I'd done Lear, I'd done all the stuff at the RSC and the, and I was a pretty major actor in the UK, and I decided. And I came here to do Strange Interlude, which I did on Broadway.
Oh, huh? Yeah.
In the 1980s.
Right.
And I also did another play at the same time. It was a very similar situation to now. I did a play at the Public, which was a big success, called Rat in the Skull.
Oh, yeah.
Where I got my great notice from Frank Rich.
Well done.
Friend.
Yeah.
And so what
You're
happened?
Working with Frank on Succession.
He's
yeah.
our godfather.
Yeah,
Frank
yeah,
is the godfather of Succession.
Yeah.
So what happened was that I decided, you know, and I was 50. I decided I'm going to go to the States. I'm going to go there and just see. And of course, people always said, "What are you doing? Why?" And I was inspired by people like Gary Oldman and Tim Roth, much younger than me, and who'd
right.
done that. And I was going, yeah, they've done really rather well, and I think I could probably do well there,
right?
Because and also because television was so awful in England at that time. It had gone. Really reached an all-time low. It's now gone the other way. It's now really
right.
pretty amazing. But it was at an all-time low then. So I thought, I really better, you know, reap while the harvest is good.
Right.
So I did that. I came. And also, the big factor was, if I was going to be paid money, I'd rather be paid more money for doing crap in America than crap in England. So that's where the Scott comes
yeah.
in.
Yeah, right, right. And what have, over the years, what has been some of, you mentioned the changes in the London TV industry and sort of output has changed. What do you consider some of the biggest changes in the entertainment industry over the years?
Well, it isn't the same as it was.
Mm.
There was a kind of lineage about being an actor, particularly in the theater in the UK.
Yeah.
That lineage is gone. I mean, you know, I work with Olivier, I worked with John Gielgud,
right.
I worked with Ralph Richardson, all who were awe-inspiring. Paul
yeah.
Schofield. I never worked with Paul, but I used to watch Paul in rehearsal because
yeah.
he was,
oh, wow.
to me, he's probably the greatest stage actor there was.
Right.
You know, so that lineage kind of evaporated a little bit. And the RSC was really at the, and the National to a certain extent, but really the RSC, there was a kind of continuum there, but that started to fall apart. And so people, there was an element of people just seeing wrongly Emperor's New Clothes. and saying, oh, well, it doesn't really mean anything anymore. I think it always means something in the theatre. So the theatre became much more fractured in a way. It still works, and it's still incredibly impressive, and it's new. It's now there's now diversity. There's all kinds of stuff which wasn't around when I was a kid.
Right.
You know, I would be like an African American actor or a West Indian actor now, because I was working class, so I was given those breaks. You know, I was very encouraged, particularly in the 60s and with the casting directors in the UK. So that has changed, and the American theatre has lost a lot of its impetus, tragically, because I think this cast I'm working with in the Great Society is one of the best casts I've ever worked with. And I walk on that stage every night, and I cannot believe the intensity that's on that stage and the commitment that's on that stage. And it's rather tragic, because, you know, I keep thinking of old Tony Randall. You remember Tony Randall,
sure,
who had this great desire for an American national theater?
Yeah.
And it's something that I would like to see reinstilled, because the quality is there, but they don't know where to go.
Right.
You know, they're all thinking, what do we do after? What's our next job?
Yes.
And in the UK, there was that structure which helped me. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it hadn't been for that structure, I would never have become the actor I became. And
that is that the repertory structure?
Structure. Okay, yeah. It's the repertory structure, and it is working. But it's also work. You know, in those days, you're right. I mean, if you think of it, Ian Holm, who was a wonderful actor.
Yeah.
Ian Holm spent 10 years at the RSC. It couldn't happen now.
Yeah.
Before he got a role, before he got a sizable role.
Wow.
You know.
Yeah.
And that was that. So you had an apprenticeship. And that was very considered.
Right.
It doesn't happen now because it's so instant, you know.
Right.
I mean, a kid can come out of drama school and be playing Hamlet almost straight away.
Right.
Without necessarily the craft, but, you know, all the adherent other stuff that goes with it. So that sense of craft has been sort of, not eradicated, but a film has gone over it. A sort of a blur has gone over it in a way. And I think that's sad. I think, and I see it with these young actors here, where I think these actors deserve a better future than I know the future they're going to get, because it's pretty dog-eat-dog out there. Mm-hmm. And it's also dog-eat-dog from the producing point of view. I mean, I think the way people are cast in this country, I think casting is, they're so rude. They are so incredibly rude.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
So how so? Can you elaborate
just
a little bit?
So offhand. I mean, the actors come in and they, you know, they do it on tape, and they never meet anybody.
Right.
They do it in a way, and it's some secretary who's dozing or some casting assistant.
Yeah.
So there's no, I mean, that didn't happen when I came here. When I came here and I got my big break in Manhunter,
right,
I, you know, Bonnie Timmerman, who was a wonderful, infamous casting director, she saw me, she interviewed me. You know, Marion Doherty, there's this wonderful program about casting. There was a tradition of casting, there was a care. And there's a lack of care now. There's a rudeness. I see it with my wife, who's a wonderful actress, and she goes through it all the time. And I just think, this is not good.
Right.
This is really not good. We're about humanity. Right. That's what we do.
Right.
And there has to be humanity in the room, you know.
Yeah.
You know, in order to do what we do.
Right.
And I think that's been gone. And I see it with these kids here I'm working with. They deserve a much better, they deserve much more respect than they get.
Yeah, interesting. And you're in the Great Society through the end of November. And what's next for you after this? You mentioned that Succession season 3 happens in the spring.
Season, I've got this film coming out now called The Etruscan Smile, which again is a pet project, because again it's something that really, you know, I know Scorsese's been going on about this, you know, not liking
the Marvel films.
Well, I don't dislike the Marvel films. You know, I mean, there is an argument that Scorsese, his films always have the same themes, which are, you know, the corruption of the American business and how it translates into mafia. You know, he doesn't stray from that Italian basis. So I don't mind it. I think it's because he's a genius.
Right.
You know, he's a brilliant filmmaker. But what I do mind is the fact that in the cinemas, there are five screens. And there are four screens showing whatever Marvel, whatever DC comics are going on.
Yeah.
There's that one cinema. And there are so many films fighting for that one cinema.
Yeah.
And there is nothing like... That's why festivals are great and very important. Because there is that element of community. Yeah. And community, and my film, Kruskin Smart, is a life-affirming film.
Yeah.
You don't get lots of life-affirming films nowadays.
And as you look ahead at the kind of stuff you want to do as an actor and want to sign on for, what has guided you in your choices? What?
Well, young directors, young visionaries. I did a film called LIE several years ago.
Oh, yeah. Great movie.
Yeah, you know, and that was a movie that people said, you don't want to be playing that character.
Right.
And I said, no, I think this is interesting because it's a, it's an interesting dilemma.
Yeah.
That kind of thing, Michael Cuesta, working with Ellie Wes Anderson, you know.
Right.
I've worked with a lot of people at the beginning. That's of, and also the scripts, you know. I did a film with, a wonderful film with this Icelandic director called Dagur Kari, and Paul Dano and I reunited after he was much grown up. It's a beautiful, it's called The Good Heart. And it's kind of eccentric, but it's a lovely film. So I'm very keen on that. And of course, doing the money earners as well.
Right.
But also now, there's a very good script I'm interested in now, which is about the opioid generation.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm really interested in doing scripts of the now, of really the crisis we are in at the moment. Even Succession is a morality tale. Succession is clearly a morality tale, and it's clearly about the fact that God is dead, and what do we have in its place? And Logan represents a sort of nihilist viewpoint, you know, that he feels he's somebody who's been disappointed by humanity. So, and you realize that people like that are a danger to humanity, and people who tell lies. And there's a lot of lying going on around us, as we witness every day, and particularly in this country, and also in the UK. So that is important to me, is really doing stuff which has a real meaning for the now.
You came over here to do film, but what, you have always come back to the theater, you were last on Broadway in that championship season. Is that important to you, to come back to the theater, and
it
why
now. It is now.
Yeah,
I mean,
why
it's hard. Well, I think because the live performance is really how I've been trained. It's where I, you know, it's where I was propelled to. I never intended. I mean, I always just wanted to do movies.
Yeah.
But then I got the theater. The theater came like a bug to me, and of course the theater in the UK was, particularly when I was growing up, was second to none. I mean, it was just the most amazing time theatrically.
Right.
And there was also a great quid pro quo between people being in the cinema like Albert and then doing films, doing theater and film. So I really feel that. And now I'm very keen on, you know, I'd like a bit more time. I'd like a normal rehearsal time.
Mm-hmm.
But I am keen on doing stuff in the theater and doing stuff, you know, that has, you know, there's stuff that I'm interested in, like I'd like to relook at something like Inherit the Wind, for example.
Yeah.
Because I think it needs rethinking, because it, you know, especially when we deal with the fundamental, you know, this whole thing of fundamentalism, and that's a play that deals directly with that.
Right.
And sometimes it gets clouded that we forget what the central issue is, what that monkey trial, scope trial is.
Yeah.
So that is something that would appeal to me.
Well, we look forward to seeing what you do next, both on stage and on screen.
Thank you, Gordon.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Gordon. That was great.
That was actor Brian Cox, now appearing on Broadway as Lyndon B. Johnson in The Great Society at Lincoln Center Theater through November 30th. If you like what you're hearing on this and other episodes of Stagecraft, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, or tell a friend. Next week on Stagecraft, I'm talking to Jonathan Groff, the theater fan favorite now headlining a new revival of Little Shop of Horrors. Until then, see you at the theater.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.